An infamous cult leader that led over 900 people to their deaths, one-third of those people being children. This is the deadliest single non-natural disaster until September 11th. This week, we're talking about Jim Jones.
You gotta love principle, but don't say, hate is my enemy. What did they say? What's that verse? Hate is my enemy. I gotta fight it day and night. And what else is the other line? Love is the only weapon. Shit! Bullshit! Martin Luther King died with love! Kennedy died talking about something he couldn't even understand, some kind of generalized love, and he never even backed it up. He shut down. Bullshit! Love is the only weapon with which I got to fight. I got a hell of a lot of weapons to fight. I got my claws, I got compasses, I got guns, I got dynamite, I got a hell of a lot to fight. I'll fight, I'll fight, I'll fight.
How long is it?
That's 48 seconds of crazy Jim Jones just saying he's going to fight. That's what we're dealing with this week.
It's madness.
That's what I've been dealing with this whole week. This has been hard. This has been a hard one, guys. And we're going to just go ahead and do a disclaimer right now. It's sensitive material. It's very sad material. There are children involved in this. So
yeah, make sure that there's no kids listening. If you have a problem with children, this kind of, I'd put it off.
It might not be for you. We will warn you before things get too bad. We're going to play some more real audio because this guy was crazy and he loved to, he would have been a crazy podcaster.
My God. If he had a Twitter account.
Yeah, it would have been bad. He really liked to hear himself talk. So there's a lot of audio. But anyway, this week we're talking about Jim Jones. So this.
The man.
Oh my gosh. He has sucked the life out of me this week. This guy was he was born on May 13th, 1931 in Crete, Indiana. So as a child, he was really into Karl Marx, Joseph Stalin, Adolf Hitler, and Gandhi.
All the good ones.
The good ones. That was quite a motley crew, the Gandhi.
All the men with a plan.
Men with plans.
Yes.
And he was also, sadly, to be a really weird kid who was obsessed with death.
Yeah, that's me.
He had an unhealthy relationship with animals. He once stabbed a cat to death and then had a funeral for it.
Good Lord.
I know, yeah. So we're getting off to a great start. All the characteristics of a young budding psychopath.
The Triforce of Evil.
Remember, okay, the Triforce is...
The Triforce of Evil of serial killers is arson. What's the other one?
Oh, okay. No, this is one where it's arson, bedwetting.
Bedwetting. And animal cruelty.
Animal cruelty.
Which is like, number one. That's the one you really got to look out for, I would think.
The animal
cruelty. Because bedwetting and fire. I mean, fire is just cool. I love fire. Fire is badass.
I also like fire, so, but definitely animal cruelty.
That is definitely,
yeah, that's the one you don't want in your kid, for sure.
Not in the Triforce. It's not the one you want.
No. And his life, his young life wasn't the best. His father was an unemployed, neglectful alcoholic. He served some time in World War I, and he had been left injured and unable to work, but he made his money as a mystic psychic.
He did. He made his money as a psychic.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Which makes a lot of sense, kind of.
Yeah, that's... Because I thought it was his mom that was the psychic, but his mom was just...
I think she...
At least he did something.
Yeah, he did something.
You know, he's like, hey, I'm a mystic psychic. I just came back from World War I.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I feel like he kind of followed in his dad's footsteps because I mean, you know, that's the...
Yeah, for sure. That definitely has to have a
Yeah.
If you're at a young age and you start believing in hocus pocus and bullshit like that, you know.
Set you on a path.
Yep.
Yeah. He became obsessed with religion as a young man when a neighbor took him to church, which was nice.
That is very nice.
He was hooked, and he was especially drawn to the Pentecostal faith. And I'm obviously always respectful of everyone's religion. Pentecostal is interesting. It's
intense.
It's a lot of showmanship, or it's
absolutely gets the people going.
Yeah,
sometimes there are snakes involved. I've heard.
Yeah, it gets you up. It's not like a thing. So he was really drawn to that shit, the energy of it, you know.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, he would actually, when he was little, he would church hop. He would go like from church to church to try to catch as many sermons as he could from people, because he just like ate it up. He loved it.
He loved like having people listening to him.
Yeah, he did. And by the age of 10, he was preaching to chickens in the barn behind his house. He would read the Bible and pretend to heal his flock.
You got to start somewhere.
See what I did there?
His flock.
Chickens? Come on.
Come on. I got it. I was good. I liked it.
I thought it was. So by the age of 16, Jones's parents had separated. From what I could tell, it was never a happy marriage. And at this time, he would take it to the streets. He would start.
Hell yeah.
In the streets, he would mostly preach to African-American people, and he was known to change his tone and message to suit whoever he was preaching to at the time.
So, oh, like, yeah, sure.
He would talk like an elderly African-American woman sometimes.
Oh, yeah. He would like walk up to you, ask you a couple questions, and then he would already know everything about you, what you wanted to hear, what you were looking for, what your problems were. And he remembered them too, because he would come back to that person like years later. Bill Clinton does this. Yeah.
That is fascinating. Moments.
He's like, I remember you. Your name is Sally, and you're married to Jason, and you got how's young Philip doing? And I'm like, he was that guy.
A schmoozer. He could read people really well. Really, really read people. So yeah, he focused a lot in African American neighborhoods. He would preach social injustice. He was really a man of the people at this time. He was really on his way to doing some good things. He was still young. He graduated high school early and started at the Indiana University. And very soon he married Marceline Baldwin in 1949, and they had one biological son.
So, oh, Marceline. At this point, he's like building a base.
Yeah.
I still think he's crazy in the inside, you know, it's just waiting to come out, but he's got to build a trust.
Yes.
On these people.
Yeah. Yeah. He's just getting started. And yeah. At this time, you know, if you didn't know about what he does, it's great. Him and his wife, they adopted a rainbow family. They were actually the first white family in Indiana to adopt an African-American child, which I thought was quite.
That's amazing. That's great.
I'm
surprised it took so long, but shit.
I know, right? Well, that was, I don't know. So
I know that was during the Rosa Parks times.
Yeah, this was civil rights movement times, which we'll get to that a little bit. But so aside from his childhood hobbies of, you know, stabbing the kitties, you think he was a good guy. And at that time, he really seemed like he was fighting the good fight.
The kitty cats, not the kids.
I'm sorry. Yes, no, not yes. The cats.
Just to clarify.
We're not stabbing children.
No.
This episode. In 1951, things really started to get going as he started his career. And at 21, he became the student pastor at Somerset Southside Methodist Church. And there he found out that plenty of people were willing to pay big money for faith healing.
Yes, faith healing. Now, I remember being very young. At Momo's house.
Uh-huh.
And I remember seeing this preacher, and he was faith healing. And I was like, holy shit, that guy is real. he can really do that shit. I was like, this is amazing.
Yeah.
And then I realized that, you know, I grew up.
Yeah.
Not like a couple of years later, I realized that it was all bullshit. But I think I asked mom. I think she was there. And I was like, is he for real? Like, is this real? And mom's like, if you think it's real.
Oh, she's so sweet.
I know. Like, if you want to believe in it, that's fine with you. I'm good.
The cake is a lie, turns out. So.
Yeah, yep.
It's too good to be true.
It is.
So this is just a weird little tidbit that I found. It's not important, but in 1953, to raise money for his church, he imported and sold spider monkeys door to door.
Yeah, spider monkeys.
Spider monkeys? So that happened. All I could find about that was that he imported them and sold them for $30.
Yeah. That's I think it's like $150.
I think so. It was like
nowadays
or $150, something like that. So that's a hell of a deal on a fucking.
Yeah, but that's a monkey, man.
I know.
In your house, like that's the missing link, and he's gonna kill you in your sleep as soon as he has a chance
and beat you with them.
Yep.
But this is 1953, and people were like, "Let's put a diaper on it and
be." Oh yeah, it's cute. Look at this guy.
I mean, it still happens to this day. So
Ace Ventura, I blame Ace Ventura. Everybody wanted a spider monkey after that damn movie. I did.
Poor spider monkeys. Eventually, in 1956, he started his own church. Don't, don't, don't. He called it the People's Temple Christian Church Full Gospel, aka People's Temple.
That's better.
Much better. This church was not only open to all races, African Americans were encouraged to attend, which at this time period was not only unheard of, it was quite bold as well.
And it's very bold.
Yeah, this was right at the start of the Civil Rights Movement. There was segregation. This was a year after Rosa Parks. So this church drew hella attention.
And at this time, he's looking like the hero. He's looking like the guy who's, you know, for the greater good.
Yep, a man of the people.
He
did a ton of work in the community for equality. He helped clothe the poor and the homeless. He donated groceries. He set up a soup kitchen. He founded two nursing homes.
He
loved old people and they loved him. And
I do too.
Yeah.
And they do too.
He, in the end, actually his congregation would consist of a third of elderly people. So.
Yeah. It's because they're so close to the end. They got to have something to believe in, you know?
Well, I don't know. I think he took advantage real, real bad. You know, I'll take care of you. You give me everything and I'll take care of you. I think they believe that, you know?
Yeah. What? They had no reason not to, you know?
No, this was a good man. He was doing good things, you know? And in 1960, he was named director of the Human Rights Commission by a Democratic mayor, Charles Boswell. With the power that came with this title, he started to try to integrate. So he's like police stations, churches, hospitals, all these things were separated back in the day between African American people and white people.
Yeah, still.
Yeah.
It's crazy. So
even like drinking fountains and shit, bathrooms. So he would set up these sting operations to try to catch restaurants that were segregating African Americans, and he called them out. And you know,
which is cool. I think that's so kind of cool.
It's all amazing stuff. I still hate this man.
Yeah, he's a piece of shit.
But at this time, it's great, you know?
He is lying. I think that the only reason why he's doing all of these things is just to build a trust foundation.
Do you think that?
I do. I think that he's... I don't know. We'll get into it.
Okay. It's so hard. It's hard to tell. Like, it's like... the chicken or the egg, which came
first. Exactly, yeah.
So we'll get into it. But so, you know, because of all the progressive thinking, people would draw swastikas on the church. One time they threw a dead cat into his house. I don't know if he threw a funeral for that cat, but he got death threats. You know, people are just shitty. People are shitty. He would take his black and white congregation to like exclusive white rich neighborhoods and go into the churches and try to worship with them, and people were pissed. They like you know, they become hostile. They threaten them with violence. It was terrible. And in a church, you know, like you can't.
Yeah, it's a church. Anybody like, should be able to go to church. Isn't...
Be nice, people.
Yeah.
But, you know, that was a different.
Different times.
Things are not perfect now either. So.
No, they're not.
But this was during the Cold War. And a lot of people were afraid of the nuclear bomb being dropped in the United States because, you know, it's like Russia and us. Are we going to, who's going to?
Sure, scary as hell.
Very scary. Like kids in school were taught to duck and cover in the event of an attack. Like if they saw the flash, they're like, get under your desk and give your little ass goodbye.
That's it. That's all you can do. It's not going to help.
That had to have just been for peace of mind. I don't understand why they did those drills.
It was peace of mind.
Yeah. So Jones became obsessed with this. He researched the best place to survive a nuclear attack. Where is that? Brazil? So he
moved
his family to Brazil?
Now, that's interesting. Like, why doesn't everybody move to Brazil?
I know, right? Yeah. Well, it's funny, too, because there's a couple other places. What he read an article about where the best place would be to survive a nuclear attack because he was obsessed with it. And there were a few places on the list, and one of them, the number one place was Brazil.
Okay.
But a couple of other places that were on the list he goes to. He's really worried about this.
Yeah.
So
it's very,
it's
like embedded in his brain, like this is gonna happen, and at a young age too.
Yeah, it was. That paranoia of just something coming for you was very, was always there with him, I feel like.
It's got to be horrifying.
And in Brazil, he tried to be a missionary. He'd ask his church in the United States to send him money, and it just didn't work out because without his crazy ass there, the church was falling apart. People were leaving. So the Brazil life didn't last long, and he moved his family back to the United States. He was still preaching about the A-bomb, but... So he moved his congregation into Northern California. This was another area that he believed would be a good place to survive a nuclear war.
Mm-hmm.
So him, and he led a caravan of over 70 families across the country to Redwood Valley, California, promising them a job and a home. So people turned over all their money and possessions over to this guy in hopes of a socialist life away from the 9-to-5 grind. And over 100 people that followed, of the over 100 people that followed Jones to California, 20% of these families were African American.
Yeah.
He really knew how to get to them. And
which is surprising because most white people don't.
I know. He really... If he wasn't such a psychopath, he would have done some good things.
Exactly. Like, if the story ended right now, it would have been great.
Yeah, Jim Jones. Very good. Yeah. Drink the Kool-Aid. Okay. We'll talk about it. That's so fucked up.
Oh, my God.
Anyway. So they got to California, and they had jobs, all right. They were working as many as 20 hours a day on the compound. So people were chronically sleep-deprived, which is perfect for brainwashing.
Absolutely. That's what the military does.
You're exactly right. Keep them tired and you can get in their head, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And anyone who actually worked an outside job outside of the compound was expected to give their entire check to the People's Temple. They were given a small allowance, but at this time they kind of were being taken care of. Like they had medical care, they had food. They did have what they needed. It was a nice community in California.
They were doing great.
They were doing good for them.
I mean, as good as they could. Really good.
Yeah. A lot of positive people, and the message was there. So church grew a ton after the move. And at this point, old Jim was then known as the prophet, started doing faith healings. So he knew this was a way to make money and also a lot of people.
Yeah.
That's what he would do. He would put one of his crew, secretary or one of his aides, in a wheelchair and put them in the audience so he could heal them in front of the congregation. And, you know, people would eat it up.
He would stage a coup.
Would stage.
Wait, that's not a coup.
No, a coup is like, I'm going to take over
Yeah, I'm gonna take over your shit.
Yeah.
What he staged a bamboozle.
Oh yes.
A schmaggledorf.
So get this. Okay. He had quite a racket going on at this time. He would have his crew get the names and phone numbers of the people coming into the church. They would tell them that it was to join a mailing list. Okay, so they get their information, and then the crew would call their phone number later and get as much information out of that person as they could. And then they would give that information to Jones, and he would call these people out by name. And this really made people believe he had a gift.
Like, yeah, why wouldn't they?
Yeah,
I mean, who's evil enough to actually do something like that?
If it only stopped there. So he'd often reaching people who were uneducated and poor. Jones would promise his followers that he would take care of them if they turned everything over to them. He would claim to provide them food, clothing, education, medicine, and they believed him. So more people joined the People's Temple.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, during all this, Jim was on speed.
Oh yeah, big time.
Serious speed.
Yellow jackets, the kind that you can get prescribed, apparently.
Oh my goodness. He would stay up all day and he'd run around. He'd go to nursing homes and hospitals. He had endless energy. Do you remember that song?
What?
That, oh, meth. Ooh, meth. Do you remember that?
I got the cleanest house on the street. I can't sleep and I can't eat.
Yeah, that I reminded me of that. I don't know why. That was the best commercial ever.
Ooh, meth. It was like it was promoting it.
Yeah, it did. It was, you got the cleanest meth, house on the street.
The fresh maker.
Yeah. It was a catchy little jingle for sure. So this obviously spirals. He's on crazy meth, and he becomes paranoid and delusional, as you often are to be on that. He's in charge of so many people. I mean, that's great. But this is the infamous sunglasses make their appearance. Because drugs, you know?
Big time. Big red eyes. No one wants to be let... No, he didn't want anybody to know that he was a freak.
No. He didn't want anybody to know that, but he was.
No. Big time.
He said that he wore them because he had ascended spiritually and his gaze would burn anyone that looked him in the eye.
Sure.
Right.
Like Medusa. Turn you to stone.
Crazy. Crazy shit. He opened a second congregation in San Francisco in 1972 and gained even more followers. He is quoted in 1973 saying, "For some unexplained reasons, I happened to be selected to be God." Jones was an atheist.
Okay.
He was a socialist and an atheist, but he was God. Okay. So in 1973, the church had 3,000 members. Eventually, the church would have as many as 7,000 members. That's a lot of people.
That's so many people.
As the congregation grew, he put together what they called the Planning Commission. Now, we could go on for hours about the Planning Commission, but I'm just going to keep it kind of short. This included people in his inner circle. The PC, as they called it, would meet daily and nightly, often for several hours at a time. He loved keeping people awake because he was awake on drugs, you know, so everyone had to be awake with him. This group oversaw disciplining the congregation. So this congregation, things were very strict. You couldn't drink, you couldn't smoke, you couldn't do drugs, you couldn't have unapproved sex.
Unapproved?
Yes. So
you had to be married, or he had to approve it.
He had to approve. You didn't even necessarily have to be married. He just had to approve that for you.
So you have to check it through him first.
Yes.
Before, okay.
Get his blessing on that. So a lot of times the discipline would just consist of counseling. So that was good. But after several counseling sessions, if you still had to be disciplined, you would be verbally berated in front of the whole congregation, among other things. This was known as catharsis. a lot of crazy things happen during catharsis.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot of stuff we could go into, but we'll just, I don't know. It's crazy. So after they would be yelled at, Jones would always hug them. He was a very much like a break them down and build them up kind of guy.
Absolutely. He's your buddy, buddy. Like he would break you down completely. And then he'd be like, you know, I only had to do this, you know, because, you know, everybody's watching and all that shit. You and me, buddy, you and me, we're going to make it through. It's
with
to the end.
Yeah.
He was like that with everybody.
And that's why people were like, oh, okay. Okay, sure. Where do you want us to go? Because he was that type of personality. There's no way he could have got this many people to follow him if he wasn't a charismatic guy.
Absolutely. He's like everybody. I guarantee you that, like, he's just like to them, he's like the pinnacle of everything that they've ever dreamed of, you know?
Yeah, everything they've ever looked for.
Like, he's a walking prophet.
Yeah. So the planning commission administered spankings in front of the congregation. Sometimes as many as 100 people would line up to be spanked for different offenses. It started off kind of tame, but that didn't last long. People were beaten with paddles and belts as many as 100 times each.
A hundred times.
Some requiring a medical attention after these beatings for their booties.
For fuck's
sake. That's a lot. With a belt or a paddle? What the hell? In front of everyone.
And it was just, it would be like what would be the offenses? Like saying like, hey, you know, can we go home?
No. That was a death threat immediately. But no, the offenses would be like talking too much or being a busybody, just like these bullshit made up things. To bring people, you know, and people got really into this. I mean, in the audio tapes, there's audio of catharsis and people are like screaming like it's Gladiator, and you know, they're digging it. They love this. Like,
oh man.
They forced boxing matches to take place. Like the guilty person will be put up against like an unbeatable opponent and forced to fight in front of everyone. People would just go crazy. And sometimes they forced them to fight naked. Sometimes they forced kids to fight the elderly. It was fucked up.
Kids fighting elderly. Kind of fun.
Oh, like a hobo. What is it? Hobo boxing.
Oh man, bum fights.
Bum fights.
Haven't thought about that in a long time, but yeah, it kind of reminds me a lot about that.
Yeah.
Just you know, it's so degrading.
So degrading, and it's just breaking you down. It's just really psychological too. It's just.
Yeah, it goes a lot. It goes really well with this.
Yeah,
bum fights. It's just like the exploitation of somebody who's, you know, going through the hardest time of their life, and you're making profit out of it.
Absolutely, exactly. He would also sexually humiliate members who had engaged in, like we talked about, the non-approved intercourse. He would. Mm-hmm. In front of the church, make them strip naked, threaten to make them have sex in front of everyone.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's so messed up. And like I said, I could go into that. So they did a ton of that, and they audio recorded a lot of it. He audio recorded everything.
Unbelievable.
It's gross. I listened to a lot of it. I really got deep for this one.
I know you did. This one was hard.
This one was
worked so hard on this one.
I did. This one was, he's always terrified me. Just like he's the one that really scares me the most out of any like serial killer or whatever guy. And to spend a week with him was dark.
Yeah.
Dark. So speaking of sex, like what a segue.
Hell yeah.
Was a bisexual, but he told everyone in his congregation that he was the only true heterosexual in the world.
Yeah, he's not gay. He just has sex with guys.
Yeah, he has sex with everyone.
He just has sex with dudes. He's not gay.
He's not gay. He's the only one who's not gay. Everybody else is.
Yeah, everybody's gay.
Not me. You are.
You're gay.
You are.
You are.
You are. So he'd sleep with a lot of members of the church, mostly women, some men. There are so many accounts of people that he, that felt that he forced himself on them. Like, there's just so many. I mean, come on. How many? I'm sure.
He had to have. Look at him.
A ton of. I know.
I don't know. There'd also be like some milfy ladies that would be like dying to get Jim Jones.
He was a smooth talker.
Mm-hmm.
He slept with many married women within the congregation. He would tell them and their husbands that he was doing it for the benefit of the woman. And sure. Everyone thought this was okay.
It's like prima nocta.
What's that?
That's, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, but that's like old English times, whenever you were married, then the king's people could deflower your bride.
Oh my goodness. Something.
Yeah, it's messed up. And that was real.
Yeah.
Prima nocta, I think it's called.
Huh.
But it's a lot like that.
Yeah, for sure. This isn't neither here nor there. I thought it was interesting. He was arrested for pulling a George Michael when he solicited an undercover police officer for sex in Los Angeles in the bathroom of a movie theater. Just saying.
Okay. This is where I get confused.
Okay.
Is this season 4 of Arrested Development?
It's the new ones.
Okay. That's why it went over my head. I was like, when does he have a proposition? I was like, geez. But the first three I know, the first three seasons I know religiously, forward and back. But the Netflix ones, I'm not.
That's a new one. I don't know the Netflix ones that much either. He was
a great show.
Oh my gosh, phenomenal show. Especially a really good show to rewatch because you catch things over and over again. Arrested Development.
Oh yeah, yeah. So you can't watch the same episode just once once.
It's got a lot of layers. Mm-hmm. He would also preach that sex within marriage was selfish, and he worked hard to break down families. The church was your family, and Jones was your father, and you didn't need anything else.
Nothing else, just him.
Just him. And of course, during this time, he was just screwing everyone and impregnating women in the church. He would make the women he impregnated have abortions. Forced abortions were common among People's Temple, and the ones that weren't aborted were raised by the community, not their own mothers. So all his love children, the ones he allowed to be born, were just kind of raised by the
community. It takes a village.
It takes a village. So people were in report members who weren't following the rules, even those in their own family. Kids were taught at a very young age to look for certain things and rat people out, you know, as fast as they could. If they saw anything fishy or heard anything, they were little rats.
Now I grew up, you know, like everybody tattletales and all that shit.
Yeah.
But snitches get stitches, am I correct?
Snitches, yes, indeed.
Often
snitches do get stitches.
So it's best to just keep your own business to yourself.
Right, because also they sometimes end up in ditches.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you don't want to be there.
No.
You'd much rather have stitches.
Yes. So why did people stay? They either had nothing at the, this is my thoughts. They either had nothing at the start and now they had something, or they gave everything to the church and now they had nothing.
Nothing. Yeah.
Nowhere to go.
I think it's more the second one.
I think so. And they felt that the church was taking care of them. You know, much of the church truly believed in Jones and his message of equality and socialism. They thought he was an amazing man that had all the answers.
Yep. He had it all figured out.
He soon became obsessed with revolutionary suicide. This was after a few of his flock had deflected. He had a couple plans at this time. One involving driving the congregation off the Golden Gate Bridge in a bus.
Interesting.
Not very plausible, I feel like. But
he had a fleet of Greyhound buses that he got at a discount.
I don't doubt that.
and the capacity is like 30, and he would shove like 50 people in there.
Oh gosh.
And they would take shifts driving, and the guy that wasn't driving, that was sleeping, he would be in the cargo hold at the bottom.
I remember hearing about that. Oh my gosh. I just feel like being on a bus made for 30 people, but there's 50 people on it, is a perfect like metaphor for this whole situation. Like,
absolutely. Yeah. It's just a disaster waiting to happen.
It's a disaster. It's a powder keg. It's like the most anxiety induced thing I can think of. Oh, what a nightmare. Get this. During a church meeting, some punch was passed around. After everyone had drank the punch, Jones was like, "You all drank poison.
You got 40 minutes.
You got 40 minutes to live. We're doing this revolutionary suicide thing." So most of them understandably like freaked out, you know?
Oh yeah.
Some people tried to escape, but they were pushed back by his guards. Dude had guards.
It's like Puff Daddy.
Yeah. These guards had guns and crossbows.
Oh shit. The bouncers or the
Once Body they car? Get to Guyana, they have crossbows and rifles.
Crossbows are so dangerous.
It's like, so they are violent.
It is because it's silent and it's way more powerful than one of those bows that you draw back.
Yeah,
it's like a gun. It's like a gun going off. It might as
That's
well.
That's gotta
be.
Hurt. I know. It's rough. So they're freaking out, you know, but then he's like, okay, so there's no poison. It was just a test to see who would be loyal to him.
Mm-hmm. And during all this, he's looking at the whole audience and he's like, okay, she's freaking out. She's cool with it.
Yeah.
He is like, I don't know, maybe.
Yeah. He
doesn't believe me.
Yeah. This guy smells my bullshit. There's no. Yeah. So yeah, he wanted to see like kind of, he liked to test it out several times, mm-hmm. see who would follow him. Yeah. As his drug use escalated, his paranoia shot through the roof. He believed the church was being targeted by the US government and that they were going to be attacked. At one point, one of his churches was set on fire and it had to be rebuilt, but the arsonist was never found. So just take that what you will. At this time, he was really trying to prove to everyone that the government was out to get them and they had to, you know, like fight against the government. So
sure, yeah. If nobody fessed up to it, then it just proves them right.
There's your fire, your trifecta. What if he set the fire? Oh my God, Whoa. It's all coming together now.
Now I guarantee you he pisses the bed.
Yeah. Yes. 100%. Oh, need some pull-ups over here.
I'm a big kid now.
He also orchestrated a fake assassination attempt on himself. He was shot in front of a bunch of followers. His wife and his aides, they ran to his side and they're like, oh, he's got a fatal gunshot wound. Then he popped up and declared that he had healed himself.
Sure, yeah. And if you hear the footage and stuff from it, it's just unbelievable panic. Like it's sheer terror. Like the fact that he got shot, everybody's surrounding the tent that he's in, getting medical attention, he's dying and all this shit. People are losing their shit.
That's their dad, that's their God, that's their prophet. That's everything.
Oh my God. Well, yeah, you hear that it. That is
their everything.
It really strikes a chord.
This audio was so hard to go through. It changed me a little bit.
It does. It changes everybody who hears it, I think.
I think so. It's pretty rough. A handful of people who had deflected from the church came forward to the media about what was going on at People's Temple. Word was getting out about him stealing the elderly, the sex scandals, the drugs, and just the treatment of the people within the church in general. That's when Jones was like, okay, let's get out of the United States. The government is out to get us. We can't be happy here. We have to leave this country.
Vamanos.
Vamanos, indeed. Because of all the harassment in the United States, he sent several members to Guyana to find a place there for them in South America. They were looking for a place away from persecution, segregation, and racism, a place where they could build a socialist community. This was called the People's Temple Agricultural Project, but of course he named it Jonestown.
Hey, it sounds like paradise. It's like Lost. It's like, although you lost, you still on a beach in Hawaii.
He really talked it up. Jones and his crew, they carved out land in the middle of the jungle. It was miles from any town or even any road. There were armed guards that were stationed outside the perimeter at all times. It was so fucking hot. There were a ton of bugs everywhere. It was the middle of the jungle.
The only way that he could sell this place is through videotape.
Yeah.
Because only then can the illusion be created.
Yeah.
Because it is such a shithole that the paradise that he supposedly calls it is non-existent.
No. He said a couple times, it's 76 degrees here all the time. 76.
All the time.
It's like,
it's always sunny. The sun never goes down. haven't seen the moon in 5 years.
It's 150 degrees with 100% humidity. You're in South Africa. No, it's not 76 degrees.
Not pleasant.
So yeah, it was not ideal. Like I said, it was hot. There wasn't enough food to go around. Like he promised, he had sent a propaganda video back to the United States, and he showed food and supplies. He said that they had like fruit, and they had Flavor Aid, and they had all kinds of stuff.
And he was holding a banana, and he's like, "This is the most natural banana that you'll ever be able to eat, and yeah. It's yellow as fuck.
Yeah,
like it's GMO'd out the ass."
Yeah. He
bought it at a supermarket. They found out he bought all of it at a supermarket because nothing else grows in
there.
There's
nothing. Climate. I mean, yeah. And he's like, it's beautiful, it's accepting. And they continued to work the very long hours. They were just like they were before. They had to work the land that was pretty much unworkable. There were double the people that were expected to come at the time. It was barren and there was a severe food shortage. So despite all this, Jones gained weight in Guyana. He had his own house with, you said, air conditioning?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he had full-on air conditioning.
He had
Diet Pepsis. He got a little mini fridge.
Yeah, he had like a generator to keep his drinks cold. And he got heavy in Guyana and everybody else was eating rice. A lot of his followers moved to Guyana, eventually making up a community of around 1,000 people. They were forced to surrender their assets and their passports were taken for safekeeping. So I just want to emphasize this point. These people are in the middle of the damn jungle. They have absolutely nothing and no way to even prove their identity. And not to mention there are freaking armed guards surrounding the place. They're 100 miles from the nearest town, which is Georgetown. They are truly trapped at this point, but most are happy to be a part of the church and community and still fully support Jones and his ideals.
Most.
Some people got there and were like, shit.
Yeah, like you promised us all this stuff, man.
We're screwed. Drugged up, Jones would preach for hours. I consider it preaching. It's more like the rantings of a narcissistic, psychopathic madman, but
it really is. There's nothing positive about any of it. It's all personal shit.
It's yeah. In the beginning, like at first, when he first started preaching, he was well spoken. He was he never like stumbled on his words or anything. And then as the drugs get worse and worse, like he just gets crazier and crazier, and he barely makes any sense. And he cusses, which he never did in the beginning. He goes nuts.
Yeah.
He'd preach for hours, and he would even hold what he called White Night. So
this is White Night.
White Night. Okay. So what he had microphones set up in the whole camp, and he had his little intercom thing in his room. So he could just pump nonsense through these speakers all day, all night in his room, you know, preaching and carrying on. Sometimes if he was really drugged up, they would shut off his microphone. So
that is so funny That is so fucking funny.
I can just imagine him.
Yeah, the silhouette just ranting and raving and going nuts.
Really getting it. And nobody...
You can't hear a goddamn thing. That would be nice.
So he would call everyone over the loudspeaker to come to the pavilion at all hours of the night, and he would call it White Night. He would keep people up all night while he ranted and raved, and they'd work all day. He was doing a really good job of keeping these people, you know, down mentally and keeping them afraid. Like, he just stripped these people down.
Yeah.
Many times during White Night, they would discuss revolutionary suicide. They would practice mass suicide. Jones claiming if they go down, they all go down together. He would lie sometimes about mercenaries coming into town to torture the children and kill everyone. So he'd make people line up with pitchforks and rakes to stand guard for the town, and nobody would come, and they'd stand there for hours. Like, it was just the craziest stuff. Other times he would do the Flavor Aid drill.
Yeah.
A couple times preparing everybody for the day. Huh?
Preparing everybody, yeah.
Yeah. He's quoted as saying, "I love socialism and I'm willing to die to bring it about, but if I did, I'd take 1,000 with me."
And who else is he going to take besides the people he's talking to?
Exactly. Right? The red flag here, sir. They knew. Go. Yeah, can I just, like, I'm going to step out.
Yeah.
Peace. It's been real.
My Uber's here.
I got to go. Everything was unraveling fast, rumors of theft and sexual assaults within People's Temple. He started becoming even more delusional and paranoid. Okay, so on April 11th of 1978, a group known as the Concerned Relatives of Jonestown, they issue an accusation of human rights violation against Jim Jones. So their family's been taken, they feel like, they've joined a cult. It's the family members in the United States that get this going, like, "Hey, I think there's something going on here. My sister's over there, whatever. And I don't think they're letting her come home."
Yeah.
Pressure was put on this California congressman named Leo Ryan, and was put on by the family members because they were concerned about what was going on there. They were hearing.
They didn't know what the hell was going on.
Yeah, they didn't know what was going on. They didn't know if they were being kept there, you know, against their will, which they kind of were. Well, some people were, but. So they want to get their family members out of Guyana and away from Jones. So Leo's kind of the guy to do this, Leo Ryan, the congressman. A little backstory on him. He was known for going places no one else would go. He once observed the conditions of Folsom Prison by spending 8 days locked inside.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Like Johnny Cash.
Johnny Cash. He didn't think too much about what could happen to him and his crew down in South America. He had a very kind of like a fly by the seat of the pants attitude about him. That doesn't work out.
No.
But pressure was put on him to go to Guyana and find out what was really going on there in People's Temple. So him, along with some reporters and the family members of the people of People's Temple, they finally arrived in Guyana on November 15th, 1978. The congressmen and the reporters were actually welcomed to Jonestown with dinner and entertainment. They were understandably uneasy. They've heard all these terrible things about Jim Jones and Jonestown, and everyone seems so happy and well cared for. They really put on a show that night. They sang and they had a big meal when they would always just have rice with little bits of meat in it on any other night.
They were going to go back and say, like, "This place isn't as bad as everybody says it is."
Yeah. They were kind of fooling them for a little bit.
Yeah.
So during the visit, some people from the church asked Congressman Ryan's group to help get them out of Jonestown. One man even passing a note to a reporter that said, "Help us get out of Jonestown. Talk about having some balls." That guy.
It's bad whenever you have balls to just barely slide a note over. Ugh. Like, that's the kind of control this guy had.
Yeah, that you're so terrified. Yeah, that you're so terrified.
They don't even have a choice. Like, they're stuck. They're stuck.
So scary. It gives me chills. So the next day, the note was shown to Jones. This was after they had arranged for the people that wanted to get out to get out. They did show the note to Jones. He was agitated, of course. He actually tried to bribe the members to stay. He offered them cash and their passports back.
He had a real temper.
He had, he
would lose his shit.
Yeah. But these people have been held hostage for 7.5 months and they saw their out and they took it. And
I don't blame them. I would have done the exact same thing.
I hope I would have done the same thing. I probably would have been too.
Yeah, I hope I would too. Yeah, ugh. I probably would have been too scared too. That's a good point.
Very, very scary situation. So, you know, they'd fooled the congressmen. Everything was okay. They were going to go. They were leaving. But as they were leaving, you know, you had Ryan and his gang. You had some reporters. You had the people that were leaving and the family members. So an attempt was made on Congressman Ryan's life. A man came up behind him and tried to slit his throat. Others were able to get the knife away, but it's not known if Jones told the man to do this or if he did it on his own.
Mm-hmm.
So like they were able to subdue the guy and it kind of wasn't that big a deal, but it's like, wait a minute, you just convince everyone that everything's okay and then you try to kill the guy?
Yeah. So yeah, what the fuck?
Yeah. On November 18th, 1978, Ryan and his group, along with a small group of people from the temple, left Jonestown. This would be the beginning of the end. So Jones had ordered his guards and his posse to go after the congressmen and the rest of the people and said to not let them leave. Once they got to the airstrip, they realized that they were going to need another plane to fit all the extra people they had rescued from Jonestown. I really don't think that he thought it through very well, that he would be bringing people back with him. Excuse me. So as the U.S. Embassy was getting them another plane, everyone is standing around just kind of like nervously waiting. They knew they weren't in the clear yet.
Yeah, they knew that they were in the wrong, actually. They're not supposed to, you know, double cross Jim Jones.
They were still afraid. And as the second plane shows up on the airstrip, a vehicle pulled up. Three men exited the vehicle and began opening fire on those on the airstrip.
It was a bloodbath.
It was a massacre. Five people were killed that day, including the congressman, Congressman Ryan, one deflector, and three journalists. The shit has just hit the fan.
Yep.
Back in Jonestown, Jones has gathered everyone to the pavilion, telling his congregation that the congressman is dead and that people are coming to attack them in retaliation, saying, if we can't live in peace, let us die in peace. Enough of the trial runs. Today was the day to die.
Trigger warning, this segment contains real audio from that day. It is very hard to listen to. Listener discretion is advised.
Get us some medication. It's simple. There's no convulsions with it. It's just simple. Just please get it before it's too late. The GDF will be here. I tell you, get moving. Don't be afraid to die. If these people land out here, they'll torture some of our children here. They'll torture our people. They'll torture our seniors. We cannot have this. Are you going to separate yourself from whoever shot the congressman? I don't know who shot him. Speaker Pete and those.
It's almost like you could hear somebody in the crowd.
It's
like talking, like speaking up.
Yeah, well, there is one lady who does speak up. And she talks to him for a while. But the medical team had mixed up Flavor Aid and cyanide in a huge vat and brought it out to the pavilion. The children went first.
Are you gonna get the medication here? You got to move. Marshall, you got 40 minutes.
You have to move, and the people that are standing there in the aisle, go stay in the radio room yard. But everybody get behind the table and back this way, okay? There's nothing to worry about. Everybody keep calm and try and keep your children calm. And the older children can help love the little children and reassure them. I'm crying from pain. It's just a little bitter tasting, but they're not crying out of any pain. Annie McGowan, can I please see you back?
What I used to do before I came here.
No, it's not just bitter.
There are some people who have tried to kill themselves by drinking cyanide and have failed. And let's just say, I'm not going to, let's just say that it doesn't work out very well. So it's very bad.
I'm going to say it. So it takes anywhere from 5 to 20 minutes for you to die, first of all. First, your body starts to convulse. Then your mouth fills up with a mixture of saliva, blood, and vomit. You froth at the mouth, and then you pass out and die. It's horrific. They would force the children to drink it, or if they were too young, they would use a syringe and squirt it in the baby's mouth.
That's so fucked up.
Yeah.
Mother, please. Mother, please, 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 don't do this, don't do this. Sit down your life with your child, but don't do this.
Some people ran and were shot in the back by the armed guards. Some were found with bent needles in their arms from being forcibly injected by the poison. Several people willingly and gladly laid down their life for Jones and were true believers till the end. He, during this whole, so this, from the first person to drink the flavor aid to the last person that died, it took 4 hours total.
That's really not that long. When you considered 913 people
had to drink some flavor aid.
Died in 40 minutes.
Yeah.
Like that's five, 4 hours. I mean,
yeah. It was later found that Jones had ordered the cyanide 2 years before this day. It is not known if this was his intention all along.
Well, he had a plan to do something with it.
Yeah. He had it around for some reason.
And he was awful fond of the Kool-Aid threats.
Yeah. He'd used it before. Well, he knew about it for 2 years, so.
913 people died that day, 276 of them being children. Jim Jones was found with a fatal gunshot wound to the side of his head. It's not known if the wound was self-inflicted. The man couldn't even die the way he forced his people to. What a colossal piece of shit.
This was not a mass suicide. This was mass murder, hands down. Hands down. He killed these people.
Yeah, you can't convince me otherwise.
No. Whether they willingly drank it or not, he killed these people.
Yep.
What's sad is 234 bodies were unclaimed from the massacre, but they are buried in a memorial in Oakland, California. I thought was really sad.
It's extremely sad.
So
there were people who did get out, though, before.
Yes. There were people from the airstrip that lived, that got away.
Okay.
Not everyone died on the airstrip. There were people that escaped to the jungle right before the massacre.
Oh.
It was actually a man who escaped the jungle and returned in time to see his wife and his infant child pass away.
Oh my God, it's like the fog.
It's rough. I'm so glad we're done with Jim Jones.
Jim Jones, this is wrapping it up.
Jim Jones has taken me to a whole nother level of, I don't even know. It's been rough.
It has.
And I love this stuff. I love, you know, true crime and stuff like this. But for some reason, Jim Jones just gets to me.
Yeah, everybody gets me in one way or another.
To me, he's scarier than, I don't know, Ted Bundy or something.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, he's like Ted Bundy's charisma times 1,000, it seems. Yeah. Times 913.
Yeah. So that was hard. The next episode is not going to be as hard as this one was, I feel like.
It's going to be a little bit lighter. I'm going to be taking most of the reins for it.
Woohoo!
Yeah, I'm going to give my sister a little break.
Appreciate it, especially after this one. Like I said, I need like 20 showers. Like, it's just like, I feel gross.
I feel you. I need at least two.
I listened to the whole death tape, so that was
hard. You did.
I did listen to the whole thing. It's out there. It's everywhere. It's incredibly disturbing. It will cut you to the core. There are children crying and screaming. It's the sound of people dying. And he recorded everything. And as this is happening, people are coming up to speak, and they're like, thank you for everything you've done. And it's just madness. It's batshit. It just, we could have gone so deep on this one. I mean, we could have talked for, you know, three episodes about this, but
we could have done two easily, but this is just an extra long one.
The heavy hitter.
Yep.
All right. Oh, we have to do a shout out.
Yeah?
Yeah. Please.
Preston?
Yes.
Hang on.
Okay.
Preston Balsall. I don't know how to pronounce your last name, but
no.
He is a huge fan of us. I know him very well. And he's out there on the frontiers, in the front lines, making this thing a thing.
See, it's military service.
Yes, he's in the military, and he's spreading the word to his military guys.
Thank you, Preston. We not only appreciate your service, but the kind words as well, and hope you enjoyed this fucked up episode.
Absolutely. Take care, man. I love you.
All right. If you have any questions, suggestions, or comments, please email us at
deadlyserial@gmail.com.
Yeah. All right. We record every Saturday. We upload every Sunday. We'll catch you guys later.
Later.